introduction, Kendrick. It's really a pleasure to be here. And I'm really pleased that the weather improved a lot since last night. So yeah, I'll tell you about some of the science that we want to do with and plan to do with CCAP Prime project, which is an evolution of the 25-meter scale CCAP project that our collaboration was developing previously, where we want to build a, now we have a reduced budget and want to build a 6-meter scale telescope, and so we've been developing a science case, well, that is really exciting, I think, and fits into the CMB research I've been pursuing over the years. And anyway, I'll tell you about today. I'll leave out some of the other CCAP Prime science cases. I mean, this is an instrument that has a wide range of capabilities, but be focusing more today on the fundamental physics and cosmic structure as described in the title. So we'll start out with a brief introduction to where we are with cosmology today. We have this concordance cosmology model that since the discovery of the accelerating expansion of the universe about 20 years ago with these supernova observations, combining those in this omega matter, omega dark energy plane, this is supernova observations 1, 2, and 3 sigma contours in blue, with the CMB measurements, such as these from WMAP in orange, led to this kind of bizarre dark energy and dark matter dominated model. And I still find it remarkable that confirmation of this model spans so much of the electromagnetic spectrum. These very different measurements of baryon acoustic oscillations, as well of galaxies in the low redshift universe, all converge at this flat universe with around 3/4 dark energy or 2/3 dark energy, and much of the rest in the form of cold dark matter. Now, confirmation of this model spans even more of the electromagnetic spectrum, such as this cute proof of the existence of dark matter with these X-ray observations of this low redshift cluster merger, this bullet cluster, where we have these two clusters that have passed through each other, and the dark matter and the galaxies are acting like a collisionless fluid. And we see from weak lensing the contours shown on the left here, showing us where the centers of total mass are, whereas the X-ray measurements of the baryonic emission from the gas show an 8 sigma offset between the total mass in these systems and the baryonic gas that's colliding in this merger. So we know that dark matter exists, but of course, what is it is one of the really fundamental other questions in cosmology today. All we do know is that some small fraction of the dark matter, a warm component, is in the form of these weakly interacting neutrinos. But even with those, the mass hierarchy and the absolute scale of the masses is unknown. They could be in a normal hierarchy, as shown on the left here, where we do know from these great neutrino observatories, from atmospheric neutrino oscillations, that one mass splitting, or here, square root of delta m squared is around 0.05 eV. And from solar neutrino oscillations, another mass splitting is around 0.009 eV, which means the sum of the masses that, as I'll show in a little while, we're sensitive to through cosmology must be greater than a little bit, closer to actually 0.06 eV. Now, direct attempts to directly measure the neutrino mass are really challenging. So, for example, the Contrin experiment, just on the electron neutrino mass, expects to get constraints of around 0.1 eV, and which is would be surprising for the electron neutrino mass, I think, even with current constraints on cosmology. And so if we can find through measuring the sum of the masses that the total mass sum is less than around 0.1 eV, we could rule out this inverted hierarchy where you have two more massive neutrinos and one lower mass and determine the absolute scale. Now, more broadly, cosmological observations such as, of course, the CMB black body from COBE have shown the isotropy and a wide range of...
Sorry, I think there's a question here.
Yeah.
Keep up for you.
That's right.
You said that the broad cluster is proof of dark matter. That's a rather strong statement.
I don't know. I'm not aware of any other. Sorry, it's not proof. I shouldn't say proof. Strong. There's no alternative models I'm aware of that can explain.
I'll send you one.
Okay, great. that can explain the weak lensing observations combined. Yeah. I should take off proof, though. I agree. That's from a quote from their paper. But yeah. Fair point. So the homogeneity and isotropy of the universe have been observed through this wide range of observations, such as this radio galaxy survey on the left, just shows uniform distribution of radio galaxies across the sky. And this means the universe was in causal contact at early times, which this, along with the lack of the observations of magnetic monopoles, led in the 80s to the development of this, the idea of this inflationary epoch in the early universe, prior to around 10 to the minus 30 seconds after the Big Bang, when the energy scale of the universe was on the order of grand unification theories, around 10 to the 15 GeV, where the strong and electroweak forces are believed to combine. So we have this very compelling cosmological model fit by a wealth of observations, but some extremely compelling questions remain, such as, did inflation occur? And can we learn about grand unification scale physics from cosmology? What's the physics of dark energy, or are there modifications to general relativity that must be taken into account? What are the properties of neutrinos? And of course, what's the rest of the dark matter? And more broadly, how did the primordial fluctuations evolve into the structure around us today? And we're addressing aspects of these questions through improved measurements of the cosmic microwave background anisotropies. That's because the primordial CMB anisotropies contain the imprint of the physics of the early universe. And these were first detected by COBE in the early 90s, by WMAP in the early 2000s, and Planck results coming out over the last few years, where as long as these are Gaussian fluctuations, we can extract all of the Gaussian information from taking this power spectrum, where we just decompose these differences in temperatures, two-point function, into spherical harmonics across the sky, and average over the directional index and plot the power on the y-axis and the multipole moment L, or which is roughly the inverse of the angular scale as shown on top. And it's really these data that are fit to this six-parameter model with the parameters shown here that confirm this picture, or give strong evidence for, I should say, this picture of a dark matter and dark energy dominated universe when combined with the supernova and baryon acoustic oscillation measurements. So current CMB survey research, just over the last few years, we've gone from these beautiful temperature measurements by WMAP to temperature and polarization measurements. And here we have measurements from Planck, ActPol, shown down here, BICEP, Keck, so a couple of South Pole projects and a couple of Atacama projects, as well as Polar Bear and South Pole Telescope. Just in the last roughly 3 years, there's been first detections of these lensing B-mode signatures. And just over a decade ago, the first measurements of the E-modes. And now we're really just entering the regime where we're starting to improve cosmological parameters with these polarization measurements, where we can separate out the polarizations into the parity symmetric or curl-free component, the E-modes, where if you take the mirror image of these patterns, right, they stay this, keep the same sign, or this divergence-free parity anti-symmetric B-mode component that changes sign under a parity inversion. So improved measurements of these anisotropies, oh, and I should also highlight here Improved measurements such as this stage four CMB project, which we're moving towards with CCAT prime, have the potential to improve constraints on a variety of exciting cosmological parameters, such as the inflationary potential, their NS, and that's a tilt of the spectrum here, and the running of the spectral index of inflation through improved measurements of the high multipole, small angular scale, E-mode spectrum, and constraints on light relics. So any contribution to the relativistic energy density at early times, such as sterile neutrinos or certain dark matter, potential dark matter components like axions, would contribute to this N effective number that we can also constrain with the E-mode measurements, particularly because we expect foregrounds to be smaller in the polarization at these high multipoles than in temperature. And then this B-mode component from gravitational lensing will allow us to improve constraints on models of early dark energy and the neutrino mass sum. And then on these larger angular scales, there's potential to go after, and plans to go after, this so-called smoking gun of inflation, this tensor to scalar ratio that the BICEP collaboration thought they had detected a few years ago, which turned out to be dust from our galaxy. Just to highlight that exciting area a little bit more, one of the basic predictions of inflation or signatures of inflation is B modes from inflationary gravity waves. And this is because gravity waves are tensor perturbations that lead to both temperature and polarization signatures. So you can see here are our scalar temperature contributions we've been looking at, scalar E-modes, as well as for an amplitude or a tensor to scalar ratio R of 0.01, the contribution to the temperature and to the E-mode and B-mode polarization down here. And this is exciting because if we can measure it, provides us with the energy scale of inflation directly. And the best current constraints from temperature are R less than around 0.11. And just recently, in the last couple of years, from polarization measurements for the first time have exceeded the temperature constraints, combining the BICEP and Planck results, getting down to R 0.09. And we can see here, there's, as I mentioned earlier, this lensing B-mode contribution where gravitational lensing of large-scale structure converts some of the E-modes into B-modes. And that is comparable to the amplitude of the inflationary B-mode signature around R 0.01. But we think, and Kendrick's done calculations relevant to this, that we can de-lens, measure that lensing with a high-resolution instrument like CCAT prime, and remove it by down at least an order of magnitude in the coming years with CCAT prime and CMB stage four, providing a natural target, also looking at the range of inflationary models of around 0.001 tensor to scalar ratio, where would enable us to potentially rule out all large field models of inflation that have Planckian scale excursions of the inflationary potential. So just to highlight this, a detection of R would probe these grand unification scale energies around a trillion times higher than the Large Hadron Collider, and potentially provide insights into quantum gravity at these high energies if the energy scale is, well, high enough to be detectable. And this is kind of an aside, but since I'm mentioning the LHC, I just find it cool that the Higgs boson appears to be spin zero, which provides our first real direct evidence that scalar fields, not that this is really in doubt, but scalar fields like the inflaton exist in nature. Right, so how are we going to get there? Well, we've been working together in the CMB community towards this stage four CMB survey, where we're moving in time down this sensitivity curve with the so-called stage one projects, stage two, and we're kind of between, in the transition between stage two and stage three surveys right now, towards stage four with, you know, over an order of magnitude detectors than we're currently deploying. And some of the forecasts that the community has been developing from this science book that we, CMB stage four science book that we just put out last fall related to inflation here include things like we must prevent false detections, like the bicep 2 evidence, claimed evidence for inflation a few years ago. And so here's forecasts with that include 8 frequency bands, including dust and synchrotron contamination. Here's a lensing B-mode spectrum, so this is all BB spectrum here. Lensing residual after doing this delensing process, dust residual, synchrotron residual, and B-modes from inflation, from inflationary gravity wave curves for R of 0.01 and 0.001 here. So we're really digging into this in more detail. We need to improve our understanding of the frequencies we need. It's clear that we need roughly arc minute scale resolution to do this science, I think, to target the range of scales that we know are accessible from the ground to do this delensing and get down to these lower tensor to scalar ratio. And here are forecasts in this spectral index versus tensor to scalar ratio plane for current constraints. They're kind of hard to see, I guess, from the bicep, Keck, and Planck constraints in light blue, and a variety of models that could potentially be excluded with or provide evidence for, depending on where measurements like these fall in the coming years. So there's also great potential with these neutrino forecasts where, as I mentioned earlier, light relics such as sterile neutrinos or axions can add relativistic energy at early times. And we can constrain both those and the neutrino mass sum by combining these measurements with improved baryon acoustic oscillation measurements and measurements of tau from the Planck satellite. And so here are current constraints in color and then the CMB stage four constraints for a normal mass hierarchy, minimal mass, and this ineffective constraint shown here. So there's really exciting science to be done with this range of improved CMB measurements. And here's just another time scale and some of the targets for these parameters that we want to hit. And the scale of detectors and sensitivity that we're trying to achieve over time, going from these kind of 10,000 detector scale instruments to around 500,000 detectors for CMB stage four. So what really informed the design for CCAP Prime was asking, how can we build instruments like CMB stage four? No, we're actually
some kind of combined sensitivity.
It's mostly just more detectors because, well, at least the project I'm most involved in that's observing right now, Advanced Actpol, we've really hit the photon noise limit with our detectors. We don't have perfect yield, but we have 70%-ish yield per detector array. It'd be great to get that to 90%. But individual detectors, by cooling them to lower temperatures and understanding all the superconducting physics of these devices, we're limited by the sky emission photon noise. So we just need more like those. Yeah. Or 100 years to observe. But that's a little impractical. So, yeah, thinking about this was really what led to the development of this kind of unusual telescope optics design, this cross-Dragoni.
Yeah. I mean, the detector noise, it does depend on the properties of the detector, right? So
yes.
If you have a bigger detector, I guess there are more photons that come in. So is this more practical to have just build more detectors or just make bigger detectors? I don't know, is that, or is there a limitation?
Well, for, there's systematic concerns and then sensitivity concerns. So you can theoretically build bigger detectors that collect more photons and push down your noise. Nobody's ever done this successfully and measured polarization, CMB polarization. There's proposals out there to do it. The real downside of that, though, is you only use a tiny fraction of the resolution of your telescope. So you, because you're smearing out the telescope resolution across the sky with your bigger detector. So this is like what's planned for the Pixie project. It may work there, but you would need, if you want, say, arc minute scale resolution to do this from the ground, you might need a 20-meter telescope instead of a 6-meter telescope. And so now your telescope is driving the cost instead of your detectors. And we don't know that it works. Whereas we know these detectors work. They're single-moded, so we can understand and control the systematics. And they're what everybody's doing who's making successful measurements.
Getting back to your earlier slide.
Sure.
Increasing the number of detectors.
Wait. Here, yeah.
If you beat Falkland problem, that's a problem. To measure primordial gravitation.
It's not just increasing the number of detectors, but also increasing the frequency range substantially. Yeah, and so that's one of the niches of the CCAT Prime project also that I'll come back to in a little while. Yeah, exactly. So here, you know, this assumes, this forecast here, it includes dust and synchrotron contributions, but it assumes a very simple dust model, for example. And we don't know how complex the dust is. We have better constraints than we had before from Planck, but they're not... There is a big, significant uncertainty there. And if the spectral index of the dust varies as a function of position on the sky, we just need more different frequency bands. And we really need to just go out and measure that, which is one of the things that with our first light instrument on CCAT Prime, we'll be able to do better than anybody else, to really know how far do we have to go in frequency and how much sensitivity do we need at the shorter wavelengths for stage four. And I'll come back to frequency, measuring the different frequencies in just a minute. Okay, so here is this unusual telescope design. It's a 6-meter aperture on the primary mirror here, and the secondary actually is almost as large as the primary. So that's the downside of the design. You need two large mirrors instead of just one, but the huge upside is it delivers this enormous flat focal plane. That can illuminate roughly 10 times more detectors on one telescope than we're deploying on Advanced Akpol, SPT, 3G, and Polar Bear 2. And so our consortium, it's actually growing a bit beyond what's listed here, but here's a consortium, Cornell, Cologne, Bonn, and there's increasing German as well as US involvement the Association of Canadian Universities, and we're open to growing this collaboration more over time. So right here you can see our animation of the telescope at Cerro Chajadantor in Chile, and our new mascot is the Gato Andino, cute local Andean cat. So the CCAT Prime site is on Cerro Chajadantor at 5,600 meters, this looks to be the best site available for our measurements in these wavelengths, this wavelength range. So here are zenith optical depths of the atmosphere at 350 microns, and these scale to the longer wavelengths as well. And so Chajan Antor, these are measurements from Radford and Peterson, is considerably better than the Alma Plateau, a few hundred or 550 meters lower, right nearby, down at this level, as well as the South Pole, shown in black, and Hawaii, of course, as well. So we'll have better sensitivity and access to the shorter wavelengths that we want to pursue with CCAT Bryant. So that's one of the ways that we can improve the detector noise, though, too, by just going to this higher site. At the longest wavelengths, we gain 30% in mapping speed or so, kind of 3 millimeter wavelengths. So that's like having 30% more detectors on your instrument. Okay, so one of the concepts we're pursuing for this a stage four scale instrument on CCAT Prime is having this around 50 different optics tubes that each illuminate one array of superconducting detectors. So here's the advanced Dacpol detector array, the first advanced Dacpol detector array that we just deployed last summer, and it's working great. I'm observing with it now. And we could naturally map onto around 50 of these that could each be whatever frequency distribution we think is ideal, because they have these independent reimaging optics to couple to them. And this is really, this is going to be the scale of superconducting detector arrays for CMB stage four, because it would cost, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars to scale this up to what Intel is doing with, from right now we're at, you know, this 15 centimeter fabrication up to 30 centimeter fabrication. You'll have talked about it, but that's just not in the cards unless we find a real industrial application for these detectors, which isn't there yet. So putting this together, here is a concept for an S4 scale instrument. We'll, of course, have smaller scale instruments for first light. And it's really this, you know, instrument sketch that that I used to make the case that we could illuminate around 10 to the 5 cosmic microwave background detectors and map the CMB 10 times faster than these stage 3 observatories. So I should put this one more way, I think, in the context of what's going on in the CMB field. There's also the Simons Observatory that I'm participating in as well. That's the next stage of the ACT and Polar Bear teams, where we plan to build one or two 5 meter scale telescopes. We're working within the collaboration and with the S4 effort to figure out the specifications for these exactly, that could also be used for CMB stage four. And the Cross-Dragoni design that we're pursuing with CCAT Prime right now is a top candidate for these telescopes, although we're still comparing other designs that people are exploring. And to highlight a difference, though, some of the differences, I think these projects are really enormously synergistic first, but to highlight some of the differences, the CCAT Prime science goals are much broader due to the collaboration interests, and I'll come back to those later. There's even galactic science that people are pursuing, and star formation history science, and access to the shorter wavelengths enabled by this higher site and more precise telescope that we plan to build.
What is Cross-Dragoni?
Cross-Dragoni, that's the, so this telescope shape that with these two large aperture mirror, and it's called crossed because the beam goes through the main beam here before coming out to a focus. The person who wrote the paper is exploring this design first, and what I did in the last couple of years was just push this into a parameter space that nobody had studied yet that's really relevant and valuable for CMB stage four and the CCAT prime science as well. So brief summary of S4, right? There's this range of science cases that are tremendously exciting. Inflationary gravity waves, neutrinos, light relics, and dark energy. And we've now started this concept definition task force. I'm a member of it. There's about 20 members that are working with the funding agencies in the US, the National Science Foundation, and the Department of Energy to try to make this into a reality and figure out how all these teams, CCAT Prime, Simons Observatory, and the South Pole teams can all work together. The survey outline, we're going to have at least half sky observations, so we'll need observations from the Atacama and the South Pole. As I mentioned, roughly 10 to the 5 detectors, so many more than we could put even on these high throughput telescopes like CCAT Prime. So it may end up looking something like half a dozen or so of these telescopes scattered around the Atacama and the South Pole, potentially even other sites that people are exploring, although the time scale for developing those is may not be fast enough for what we want to do with CMB Stage 4. So now, yeah. I'm just about to get there.
Okay.
So now I'm going to focus in more on the range of activities that we're optimizing CCAT Prime for in advance of CMB Stage 4. And this is really getting into secondary anisotropies and cosmic structure measurements that are also very exciting in their own right. So one point that may be obvious, but I think it's worth emphasizing, the primary CMB anisotropy maps are really limited to this two-dimensional surface. This recombination time provides us with a 2D map at this redshift of 1,000, whereas secondary anisotropies add a third dimension of structure formation. So if we bring our telescope in and look at how the light is propagating through the universe, from the surface of last scattering, some of that light will be gravitationally deflected, so that's one secondary anisotropy, gravitational lensing, as well as spectrally shifted through the Sunyaev-Zeldovich effects that I'll expand more on in just a moment. And beyond the CMB measurements that we're pursuing now, it really looks like the most promising avenues to advance cosmology are through 3D measurements, where we need to move beyond this two-dimensional surface and measure the many more modes available in structure throughout our universe. And one of the epochs that we'll be optimizing CCAT Prime for is studying reionization when the first stars were turning on that I'll... I better speed up a little bit. I'll come back to it in just a few minutes. So I've already gone through gravitational lensing a bit. This is a relatively unique form of lensing. My time started there before I think I started talking. How much time do I have? There's a clock. Okay, good. I'm not so bad. I won't rush quite as much as I thought I had to. So gravitational lensing of the CMB is a relatively new cosmological probe that we first detected with ACT temperature measurements in 2011 at around 4 sigma that provided, for the first time, evidence for dark energy from the CMB alone. It's been detected by South Pole Telescope and Planck and Polar Bear, and just more recently, in the last few years, B-modes from lensing have been detected with this range of projects as well. And we can see, looking back at this omega matter, omega dark energy plane, now, by combining this 40 sigma measurement from Planck with the anisotropies, we can really zero in with these black contours here on the omega matter, well, the dark energy, dark matter dominated cosmological model. So this is one of the new cosmological probes that is important for advancing the field in the coming years. The other that I'll expand on a little is the Sunyaev-Zeldovich effects. So these are the spectral shifting of CMB photons through Compton scattering with hot electrons in galaxy clusters. And this is a relatively redshift independent effect in that there's no 1 over r squared cluster selection bias. And there's this distinct thermal SE signature that's shown in black here after removing the CMB blackbody, and that allows us to measure cold spots at lower frequencies, 150 gigahertz. There's a null around 220 gigahertz and hot spots at 270. And there's an industry of people pursuing cosmological constraints with this by following up with measurements at other wavelengths to constrain the redshift and mass of these clusters. In addition, there's this kinematic SE component, this much smaller velocity component that so far we've just measured statistically by combining ACT and ACTPOL measurements with a baryon oscillation spectroscopic survey. And we've been exploring how to use those measurements for cosmological constraints. It's also been, there's evidence for this effect, statistical evidence for this effect from Planck plus Voss and SPT plus DES that's come out in the last couple of years. So to give you a flavor of what, yeah. So that's just no Momquist selection bias, because unlike any light that's emitted from a cluster, this light is traveling from the surface of last scattering and then just being spectrally shifted as it moves through the cluster. So there's, it's not dimmed by 1 over r squared.
No, but I mean, the size of the cluster is smaller if you go.
A little bit, but because angular diameter distance flattens out. So I'm thinking at 1 over distance between us and the cluster.
Yeah, but there's the same.
So if I scoot along to to this here, the point is, because we're not depending on light emitted from the cluster, we can make an approximately mass-limited catalog. Where this curve, that is relatively independent of redshift.
Right.
And if you're trying to detect these optically, for example, then the number of photons you receive dims as 1 over r squared. Whereas if you're using the CMB as, looking at basically shadows in the CMB, it's not dimming in that same way.
A small
redshift. No, that's because of the limited resolution of Planck. This curve here. So this is the actin. This is a Planck plot. So the actin SPT points are much dimmer. But that's, if you focus on those, the six meter and 10 meter scale telescope measurements, then there's not this. Real resolution limit that's observed by Planck. So we can go back to this a little more, discuss this more afterwards. So here are just a handful of clusters we discovered with ACT 5 years ago now. And you can see they look the same as a function of redshift. right? Between redshift of 0.4 and 0.9, at least, these all just look like blobs. We're not resolving them. They're well matched to our beam size with a 6-meter telescope. And that contrasts with the optical measurements, where we see the yellow dots here are galaxies that are members of this cluster at redshift of 0.4. Then they're turning distinctly orange here at redshift 0.5. And for this higher redshift 0.9 cluster, the dominant galaxy members are distinctly red in this false color image. So that redshifting of the signal from the clusters, as well as the dimming of this optical light emitted from them, makes it much harder to detect them, detect the light emitted from the clusters than the SE signal. And this redshift 0.9 cluster is a cool cluster. It's a high redshift analog of the Bullitt cluster that we've done lots of follow-up with, and other groups have as well at this point, with Chandra. This is a Chandra image, as well as optical and radio. And this is, you know, one more handle with these massive clusters that we can use to probe lambda CDM via the growth of structure. And we were particularly keen when we discovered this to see the results from Planck, because we discovered this massive cluster in just an 800 square degree field, and thought, okay, if there's many more of these, this would be a problem for a lambda CDM. And we've only measured, you know, 2% of the sky. What's that? El Gordo, yeah. So this is the fat one in Spanish. I was named by Felipe Menantao, who led the analysis and follow-up of this cluster. And I think partly because of the name, it got a lot of amusing press. The fat galaxy cluster discovered 7 billion light years away. And amusing reader comments like, this obesity epidemic is far-reaching and getting out of hand. So anyway, back to this plot, we were particularly interested to see where this would fall in a Planck plot. We knew Planck would be limited to only the most massive clusters at this higher redshift because of the larger Planck beams. But it really, despite, you know, we basically got lucky that we discovered this extremely massive cluster in such a small region of the sky, and there aren't additional ones that would be in tension with lambda CDM. What's that? Yeah, so it's a statistical anomaly, but it's within the range of expected masses at this redshift. It's a, you know, the only one we know of in our universe at this redshift. Of course, there's larger ones at lower redshift at later times as well. So moving beyond the measurements here that we've been doing with ACT and SPT, we really need greater sensitivity to get to lower masses and higher redshifts, as well as shorter wavelengths to fully characterize these clusters. And that's one of the things we'll focus on with CCAP Prime. I just want to highlight, it's one of the areas my group has been spending a lot of time on, is this KSE measurements as well, which we provided some of the first evidence of by combining ACT data. So we have microwave measurements on the y-axis and optical redshift measurements from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey Baryon Oscillation Spectroscopic Survey on the x-axis. And what we're looking for here is, by stacking nearby clusters, this pairwise SZ effect, where the cluster, we expect nearby clusters to be falling in towards each other. And this, so here's the results of a simulation in black here. And so we have some evidence for this effect with this first analysis a few years ago, and then for Francesco De Bernardis, who I'm working closely with at Cornell, led this new analysis combining our more recent ACT poll results and a much more conservative analysis approach than was used in that first paper. Where we handle a full covariance matrix and use simulations to test and determine our uncertainties, and find this around 4 sigma evidence for this KSE, pairwise KSE effect here. So we're excited to keep pushing on this. with the next season, the 2015 season of ActBull data, that has a much larger area of overlap with BOSS to see how far the pairwise measurements can be extended. I want to highlight, though, that there's no direct KSE measurements that I'm aware of clusters yet. There's only measurements of substructures within clusters, or clusters, components of clusters that are merging. And so that is really an open direction that we actually, well, we've been looking at how we can use measurements like these pairwise measurements to constrain cosmology, and we really need those more direct measurements to inform the cluster properties and constrain cosmological parameters, maximize our constraints on cosmological parameters with the KSE. So here is are some forecasts that we developed with Rachel Bean and her graduate student Ava Mueller and Francesco, where this is just the inversion of the plot we were looking at previously, and model here, which is the same models that we've been fitting here, including, I can go into that later. There's also a redshift space distortion component we may be seeing evidence of at low separations. So here is forecast for the neutrino masses as well as dark energy. And we see that particularly with dark energy and gravity, they're just scaling the amplitude of these velocities linearly, roughly linearly. And that amplitude also scales with the cluster optical depth. So that's really one of the directions that we want to improve on substantially. So here are some of the forecasts we did for S4 and DESI combined measurements, where we have a conservative range, an optimistic range of constraints on the neutrino mass sum, as well as dark energy parameters. And I think this is exciting because it's complementary, another new way to probe these cosmological parameters, complementary to lensing, BAO, and others, although we really want these optical depth measurements for cosmology. And so that brings me back to CCAP Prime and the first light instrument concept that we have for it, to really probe the transition between these gravity-dominated, largest most massive bound objects in the universe and dark energy-dominated regimes, where we'd like to do the first dedicated survey of galaxy cluster motions. And we can do that by just adding a lot more spectral bands and taking advantage of the site and the capabilities of this telescope to extend to these shorter wavelengths here. So the CMB measurements are focused on the left-hand side of this plot, and adding the right-hand side, the increment, as well as higher frequency measurements to characterize the submillimeter point sources, we think will enable us to separate out the thermal, kinetic, and relativistic SE components, and then simultaneously constrain the optical depths, velocities, and electron temperatures within these clusters. And so here are some forecasts for different survey parameters that we've been exploring, different numbers of clusters and average masses that we would find in those surveys. And our preliminary work on forecasting constraints on here we have the optical depth, sorry, that's a little hard to read, and the velocity, and there's a third dimension, the electron temperature within these clusters. Comparing in pink the CCAP prime and in blue advanced ACT forecasts. So this just highlights the niche that adding these shorter wavelengths provides.
So you have three observables, optical depth, velocity, or three parameters by measure, optical depth, velocity, and temperature.
Yeah.
And you say the way you get it is by combining thermokinetic and relativistic SE, or do you make other assumptions there?
Well, we're extracting all of those, as well as contributions from radio sources and submillimeter galaxies, by measuring in seven frequency bands simultaneously.
Right. But I mean, these three conditions have a specific frequency dependency. So if you have infinite frequency resolution, you're going to get three numbers. It's thermal, kinetic, and relative efficacy.
Right.
And is that those three numbers you use to get velocity, I guess, temperature,
yes.
And optical difference.
Okay. Exactly.
Do you have to assume something for the profile of the gas, basically?
We do have assumptions for the profile that are informed by the thermal SE measurements that have been made by Acton SPT.
But there's finite resolution. These are all limited by resolution, so you don't really resolve the profile.
Yeah, we're not resolving it in detail.
So do you include, I'm guessing you include the uncertainty in the profile somehow?
Yeah, yeah, and we're working on
the marginalizer of that.
Yeah.
Okay.
And we're working on writing this all up.
Okay.
It's getting close, but we're not quite there yet. And using a realistic cluster sample to try to see can we achieve this goal of roughly 100 kilometer per second velocity measurements on order 1,000 clusters, which older forecasts that have been done have suggested this would really help with cosmological parameters. So now, is that realistic within the range of instrument and measurement foreground parameter space that we're exploring? So Averroot Mittal is an undergrad, actually, that's working with Francesco De Bernardis and I on these forecasts. And anyway, we have a bunch more of this coming together soon. So what we've been exploring, optimizing the frequencies that we observe with putting in different ranges of frequencies into a first light camera that looks like this, that's a 7 optics tube as opposed to the 50 optics tube S4 scale camera we were looking at earlier. A 7 optics tube camera matched to this F3 telescope that I think is well matched to the sensitivity of current detector arrays like the advanced ACTPOL one I showed earlier. And this is the best configuration we've found yet, having these 7 different frequencies measuring simultaneously. And in addition, adding these polarization sensitive detectors, like we're using for CMB measurements at long wavelengths, will allow us to measure the polarization in foregrounds and inform S4. And here, mentioned this already, but here's this kind of beautiful map of, it's a little dim, but from Planck, of the galactic dust polarization, Van Gogh-esque map that is a signal that contaminated the early BICEP 2 results. And these Planck measurements suggest at least several polarized dust bands are needed to get into this B-mode range of R less than 0.01, but how many really depends on the details of the model of the dust. So this CCAP Prime SZ instrument, I think, would have this unique niche in the CMB community, improve constraints on inflation via these foreground measurements, and understand this galactic dust, so-called turbulent energy cascade, that is interesting galactic physics in its own right. So finally, I mentioned earlier there's other plans to characterize the epoch of reionization with CCAP Prime, specifically address questions like how and when do the first stars and galaxies form? And carbon 2 or carbon plus is the brightest emission line in star-forming galaxies that allows us to pursue intensity mapping, where we're just integrating the signal of this emission line over a range of redshifts between, roughly up to redshift 10. I guess my lines go back maybe a little far here. Maybe the offset in the plot isn't quite right. But there's big uncertainty in this exact redshift range and the processes that drove reionization at these times. And one of the complementary approaches that's being pursued is neutral hydrogen 21 centimeter lines that can probe all the way back to the dark ages prior to reionization. That's one of the goals of this planned square kilometer array reionization probe this billion-dollar scale instrument, both the C plus and the 21 centimeter will give 3D spatial information from spectroscopy and allow reconstruction of the mass distribution of the structure throughout these range of redshifts. And part of the question here is, can we beat projects like SCA to the punch with this C plus intensity mapping? So C plus emission occurs in the rest frame at 158 microns. It's redshifted into the millimeter range over redshifts, between redshifts of roughly 5 to 9. And it allows us to detect the inverse of the 21 centimeter signal. So the 21 centimeter is neutral, and then once that becomes ionized and galaxies are beginning to form, you can see, for example, in this dark region here, there's a lot of bright galaxies emitting this C plus signal in the simulation. And there's been recent progress in this, in high redshift detections of C plus with ALMA that are, you know, give credence to this concept of pursuing reionization measurements through C plus spectroscopy. Yeah.
Map out the radial direction, or do you just need integrated over a wide band?
It's observing with reasonable spectral resolution. Spectral resolution of a few hundred is what goes into these forecasts. So using a spectrometer as opposed to an intensity, a broadband intensity measurement like we do for the CMB. So there's a couple of different ways that we're considering upgrading a first light instrument like this KSE optimized first light instrument, to enable spectroscopy with it. One would be just putting Fabry-Perot interferometers out front that you scan back and forth through different spectral ranges as you observe the sky. And another is there's these superconducting spectrometer detectors being developed at a handful of institutions that could allow us to just replace the detector arrays. And there's a ways to go before those are ready, but we're not ready to deploy it yet either. So that could be a really exciting approach that would enable even better measurements than are included in forecasts like this one here. Where we have wave number on the x-axis, and then there's Jansky's per steradian squared on the y-axis here. And for different redshift bins, we can compare and test different reionization models with measurements like this. And one last, very last comment related to this that I'm interested in exploring is there's one, and related to inflation, one more signature inflation that is compelling to pursue is non-Gaussianity. And this requires higher order statistics than we use in the power spectra, although this is a three-point function that is parameterized by this dimensionless amplitude FNL. We're using the four-point function for gravitational lensing measurements as well, so it's an intermediate complexity, I guess. And there's a natural target. The case is made in this from the CETA workshop a couple of years ago, FNL around 1, where you expect FNL larger for multi-field. And there's three different types of FNL being considered here, depending on the shape of the triangle that you're mapping onto the sky. For FNL local, greater than 1 is expected for all multi-field inflation models, and FNL equilateral and orthogonal greater than 1 are as expected for single-field non-slow roll models. So that whereas only single-field slow roll models of inflation would have much smaller FNL. So here are Planck measurements, which provide the best constraints so far on non-Gaussianity in this three-dimensional plane that's kind of pretty to look at least, if not trivial to interpret. But they've measured expected non-Gaussianity from the ISW effect. And so far, though, with any of these non-Gaussianity from other sources like inflation has only limits on it, as shown here, of limits of around 5 for local and 20 and 40 for the other types. Now, we can improve on these by about a factor of 2, we think, with CMB stage 4, which is worth doing, but we really need more modes to reach FNL of around 1, and that's where large-scale structure comes in. And so it looks like large-volume spectroscopic surveys have the potential to achieve FNL less than or equal to 1. For example, here's a SCA 21 centimeter forecast with, for different spectral resolutions, considerably lower than FNL of 1 in, with multiple different instrument configurations. Some of the challenges, though, are this might require, for example, putting SCA on the dark side of the moon because of all the Earth foregrounds, in addition to astrophysical foregrounds that may contaminate measurements like this. But with C+, we can access not quite as large of a volume, but a significant volume, within a factor of 2 or 3 of the volume that is included in a forecast like this. And we could potentially host a much larger spectrometer on a telescope like CCAP Prime in the future. So one of the questions that I'm hoping people will dig into more is, can this C+ reionization probe constrain primordial non-Gaussianity? Because it's, would be an exciting future direction that would be an order of magnitude, if not more, cheaper than a project like SCA, and complementary in many ways that could be used through cross correlations to pursue this and advance both instruments as well. So sorry, I went a little longer than I expected, but here's a summary of what we're doing, and CCAP Prime, exciting new capabilities in these areas that I described. We're planning telescope vendor selection in March with construction following board approval in just a couple of months, and additional participants are welcome. So thank you for your time. Yeah.
Regarding the reionization.
Yeah.
And it fit the idea of CAB out of the perspective. One of the parameters is the redshift of reionization.
Mm-hmm.
If you put it equal to 11, you get a very good fit to the 2015.8,
mm-hmm.
which is very accurate.
Mm-hmm.
So, if you don't use that, you don't get some good fit. So what about that?
What about the
fitting the prospect
of the CIB? So I don't know if I'm there may be better people in this room to answer that than me. But so that provides some constraints on when reionization occurred. And yes, we'll also make progress on when it occurred with improved CMB and CIB measurements. But the details of how it occurred, we'd really like to measure with emission from these higher redshifts directly, like an intensity mapping approach. Does that answer your question at all?
So my people just fit for the optical depth, so I don't think I have to assume anything about
this stuff. You run CMB first. You have to put in a realization image.
Sure, but that's one of the three parameters they fit for.
Yeah.
So what's the the problem.
Well, you don't fit unless you get it right.
Like a larger distinction between just the total screen, screening to the CMV, the full lock for that, and the inhomogeneity of the intersection. That hasn't been observed. It'd be consistent with your data. If you, I mean, it's artificial, but if your annotation just is a bunch of time but not space, then
right.
It's consistent with your
persons. Right. So there's no spatial information, or not significant spatial information in those measurements. For CCAT Prime? I don't have it in these slides here, but I'm happy to share, give it to you afterwards. We do for each of those bands, and that's what we've been playing around with, the different, looking at the different KSZ instrument configurations, and that'll be in the publication too that we're working on, but I'm happy to share it now. Yeah.
I was just curious what so basically the C plus tomography that you're proposing to access FNL.
Mm-hmm.
What's the maximum redshift that you can usefully go to where there's still a signal? And second of all, I guess this is something that requires this spectrometer to be built, and are the redshift resolution that you need to usefully do those things that are possible now, or
I think the redshift resolution that we are baselining for an instrument like this is better than is assumed in these 21 centimeter forecasts. Okay, so that should be straightforward with Fabry Pro interferometers, at least. The on-chip spectrometers, they really need to be proven.
Is that just because it's easier to get a better spectral resolution at shorter wavelengths, or?
I'm not sure what limits these. I was surprised these spectral resolutions were so low in this forecast, but I'm not a SCA expert. They were, 20, this was 10 to 20, and this was a couple hundred maybe. That SCA, you're doing heterodyne measurements, so the data volume is just insane because you're measuring the phase and amplitude as a function of time, and then I think it may just be, even scaling computational power, you can't keep all that data or something, I'm not sure. But spectral resolutions of thousands are relatively straightforward to achieve with optical spectrometers. So a few hundred is actually degrading what people are doing in this wavelength range. Like Gordon Stacey has who really excited about and focused on this upgrade as making higher spectral resolution measurements in millimeter wavelengths on the APEX telescope with an instrument.
And what's the useful range of redshifts that you can do this time?
Right. And just from looking at papers like this, at least 6 to 8, we think we can do 5 to 9. And if you compare the volume there, it's from 5 to 9, I was estimating the other day, it's maybe a factor of 2 smaller volume than went into these forecasts, which are redshift 30 to 100, but the volume is just compressed at those higher redshift range. And so it's a little bit, maybe a factor of 3 if you only consider 6 to 8, something along those lines. Any other questions? Yeah.
There. Currently, the errors on those are something like 1,000 kilometers per second.
Yeah.
You're quoting 100 kilometers per second. Some of that noise must be from intrinsic CMB background temperature fluctuations, but I guess that the fact that you're going down says that's not the dominant source of noise that is that true? Is that extrapolation correct?
Yeah, it's the dominant noise source is the maps, the sensitivity of the maps, and not being able to separate out all this diverse range of different components here, because there's just too few spectral measurements. And so people have been using, you know, well, with some of the ACT clusters, there was follow-up with Aztec and with Herschel, and combining all these data sets and getting around 1,000 kilometers per second. But those all have lower sensitivity than the bands that we're talking about here will. And there's fewer bands, even when you combine from several instruments. And then there's all these very different instrument effects that need to be taken into account when you're trying to combine data sets from instruments that you can't understand all of them, right? So multiple contributions. I'm not sure that we'll get down to as low as 100. I think in the most massive clusters, we may do a little better. But with thousands of clusters, you know, if we have 20,000 clusters and 300, is that as good for cosmological parameters? Or, you know, so that's the parameter space that is kind of our next goal to explore as well. First, hopefully, by next week, we'll have histograms for all of these clusters of, you know, what kind of velocity constraints we expect for them. And then we can move on to cosmological parameters from there. I was hoping I'd have it for this talk, but it's not quite ready yet.
Thank you.
Thank you.